Hi, everybody. Thank you for being here tonight. I'm eager to chat with you about restlessness tonight. Was that Satish that said that he gets restless legs?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about restless legs. So
Good, good.
stay with me, okay? Well, before I start talking about restlessness, let me do just a little bit of background. I know there's at least one person here who hasn't been following our sequence for a while. I would like to welcome her. Robin Lesser is a good friend of mine, and I've dragged her to this session tonight. Thanks for being here, Robin. Appreciate it. As many of you know, we've been studying the four foundations of mindfulness, and if you we're here on February 11th. Peter gave us a really nice overview of the four foundations. And then we began to dive more deeply into the foundations in the next 2 weeks. Has that been 2 or 3 weeks? Susan Baxter introduced us to mindfulness of breath and body, the first foundation. And then, no, that was that Susan that did that? Breath and
It
body?
doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Feelings. I think that was Susan. That was
Susan
you.
did breath and body, and then Allie did feelings, I think,
Oh, I
and
think
then
you're right. Yeah, Allie did feelings. And then I did, so mindfulness of feelings is the second foundation. I did a talk on mindfulness of mind, which is the third foundation. And now tonight we're beginning, we're not beginning a series, but we've started a series on mindfulness of dhammas or dharmas. And in that category is the hindrances, which I'll talk about in just a minute. So these three previous foundations that we've looked at, mindfulness of mind, body, feelings, and mind have all focused on the training that we need to go through to concentrate the mind. So, in the fourth foundation is it is, is the fourth foundation is translated as mindfulness of mental objects. We might ask. I asked anyway, you might not ask, but I asked, how is that different from mindfulness of mind? And we just did that. So are we kind of backtracking here a little bit? No, actually not. Anallio, in his book on the Satipatthana Sutta, says that Dhamma means categories of phenomena, or you might another way of saying that might be elements of experience and how they function. So that's what we're looking at in this fourth category. We have a comprehensive list of the basic organizing principles of Buddhist teachings. So we might take each of these lists as mental objects as templates to help us examine our own minds and to help us move toward clarity. So we have listed the categories, the lists that comprise this fourth foundation. The first one, not insignificantly, is the hindrances. The second one is the aggregates, which we'll get into. We have two more sessions, I think, on the hindrances beyond tonight. Then we'll move into the aggregates, then the sense spheres, then the factors of awakening. And finally, the Four Noble Truths, which also has more lists embedded in it. So this is lists of lists of lists here. And the Buddha has been called the ultimate list maker of all time. That's probably a true statement. So Joseph Goldstein, who we all know, admire, and turn to for advice and information on the Dharma, says that in this foundation, the fourth foundation, the Buddha is showing us how to investigate these truths, these dhammas, for ourselves. So you can see that the fourth foundation of mindfulness contains a wide scope of instruction. So lots of teaching. Dharma means the teachings, right? So in the Anapanasati Sutra, the Buddha gives specific directions for each of the four foundations of mindfulness for us to use as sort of direct, I call them directives. Some people call them mantras. And those of you who have been in my meditation practice sessions know that I use those in the first three foundations. I use those four directives for practicing. They're sort of like starter directives for people who are engaging in meditation. So I'm not going to backtrack over all of the previous three foundations, but I do want to tell you what the directives he laid down for the fourth foundation are. He says, breathing in, I observe the impermanent nature of all dharmas. Breathing out, I observe the impermanent nature of all dharmas. I'm not going to repeat, but it's breathing in, breathing out. Breathing in, I observe the disappearance of desire. Breathing in, I observe cessation. Breathing in, I observe letting go. So as we move through the various lists of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha gives us these directions for not just for practice in the meditation itself, but for post-meditation investigation, and gives us a protocol for how to work with each one of these lists. He strategically begins with the five hindrances, according to Joseph Goldstein, because, and this is a quote from Goldstein's book on mindfulness, because the hindrances envelop the mind and obstruct it from developing wise discernment regarding skillful and unskillful actions. They hinder the development of concentration and other awakening factors, and they prevent the realization of the Four Noble Truths. That's from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. So that's a pretty scary definition. The first time I read through that formal definition of the hindrances, I thought, oh boy, we better start really thinking about this. This is serious, serious stuff. So for me, I think it's important. It's important to notice both parts of this definition that Joseph Goldstein gives us. The hindrances keep us from skillful action, he says, and they keep us from developing concentration. So there are two parts here that we have to pay attention to as we begin to cultivate our understanding and our handling of the hindrances. We have to, this definition implies that you have to deal, I say first and foremost, with our concentration practice, our meditation practice. So the hindrances are qualities, characteristics, obstacles that each one of us struggle with in being in meditation. And then, of course, the hindrances also affect us in our real life, our relationships, our work, our decisions about how we're going to conduct our life, how we're going to live, how we're going to be in the world with some kind of meaning and purpose. So this, to me, this first category of the fourth foundation, well, I'll be able to say this about every category, but this first one, the hindrances, is just so rich and so important to me, and it's been so important in my own practice. The hindrances, then, to sort of summarize, obscure our perception and in effect hobble us in all we are trying to do in our practice. By studying them, we can notice more clearly and more directly how they influence the condition of the mind. Often they have become such entrenched parts of our inner landscape that we're not even aware of them. And I would say for most of my life, I wasn't even aware of them. We conveniently ignore them, sometimes even when we are made aware, because to notice them would require some sort of action. And so we avoid action that seems very difficult to undertake. And quite frankly, dealing with the hindrances is no easy task. But by not noticing them, they are silently impacting not just our lives in destructive ways, but they are also derailing our practice. In the connective discourses, the Buddha said this of the hindrances: they are makers of blindness, causing lack of vision, causing lack of knowledge, detrimental to wisdom, tending to vexation, and leading away from Nibbana. Okay, put the fear of God into me, Buddha. You just did it. That is not something that I want to be fooling around with. So let's review just real quickly. I'm not going to, obviously, Peter and Allie and Susan have done a good job in introducing us to this, but I want to just review them. And I want you, each one of you, to think about which hindrance most hobbles you. Which of these five hindrances is most leading away from your awakening? So the first one was that we talked about was desire. That was Susan. The second one, aversion, was Allie last week. And now usually the third one is sloth and torpor, but April and I have switched. So she's going to be next week, and I took her spot. So sloth and torpor, April will be talking about next week. And tonight we're going to focus on restlessness and worry. And then after that is Peter. Well, Peter will do a talk on his retreat, and then he's going to talk to us about doubt. Doubt, the last of the five hindrances. Okay, so I'm going to define restlessness and worry in a variety of places here tonight, but just to give you the cleanest, shortest definition, restlessness and worry means difficulty concentrating and seeing clearly. Difficulty concentrating and seeing clearly. I want to come back to that notion of seeing clearly. It often is associated with some kind of compulsive energy. It might be demonstrated by the impulse to fidget or to move. Satish talked about restless legs, and I'm going to tell you a story about a horrible experience I had in my 10-day silent retreat with restless legs. It just about did me in. It also can be characterized by an inability to focus, to keep your mind concentrated on a single thought or a single notion or a single line of conversation, a mind jumping from one thing to the next. I'm sure you all know people who do this. And maybe you do it yourself too. It also, this category of hindrance includes worry, anxiety, and agitated feelings of regret. So there's a lot to unpack here in this one hindrance. So now, before I go on, I do just want to say that I love it when a meditation teacher or a Dharma teacher cautions me to be gentle with myself, to be compassionate with what I perceive to be my failures or my inabilities or my seeming lack of reaching the aspirations that I have. So I want to be that kind of teacher too, and I want to encourage you not to think about these hindrances, which we all have. Okay, if you're a human being, you've got one or all, some aspect of these hindrances, but they're not personal flaws. They're not irredeemable qualities that you struggle with. And I know many of you have heard me say this because I've repeated this incident in many of my talks where I would have students come to talk to me when I was teaching writing, and they would say, when I was asking them about their process, they would say, well, that's just the way I am. I just jump around a lot. My mind jumps around. So that's just the way my thinking is going to go. And so we all do that to a certain extent. 18-year-olds really do it in a powerful way. And, you know, I always felt it was sort of my biggest job was to disabuse them of that belief that that's just the way they are. But sometimes we all do that, right? We fail to realize that these hindrances are normal functions of a human mind and a human central nervous system that have formed as a result of all manner of causes and conditions leading to a particular hindrance. It's important to recognize them and not to blame yourself. And as Peter was talking about right before we began, to not get caught up in the story of why you just can't concentrate or why you just can't sit still. So it's important to recognize them, not blame yourself, but gain skill in disarming them. If they are hindering you, especially if they are hindering you from moving forward in your meditation or in your life. I, again, have talked about this book in earlier talks, but I want to bring it up again here because I think it's so pertinent to dealing with hindrances. It's a book I've recommended to you before by the neuroscientist Bruce Perry. It's called What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing. And in this book, Perry reframes the question our critical minds often use when we come up against any kind of unbeneficial behavior. And we say, what is wrong with you? School teachers do this a lot, especially elementary school teachers. What is wrong with you? Why are you not handing your papers in? Why are you not paying attention in class? Perry creates a useful reframe of that approach by saying that instead of asking what is wrong with you or what is wrong with me, ask the question, what happened to you? What influences, what traumas, what role models, what social and cultural standards, what events made one of these unbeneficial behaviors an option for you? It's definable. It's worthy of investigation. Tonight, then we're going to hone in on the hindrance of restlessness and worry. And I want to begin with a quote from a fabulous book I just finished reading. Oh, I don't have it with me. It's in the other room. Sorry. It's by Ezra Bayda, Bayda, and it's called Skating on Thin Ice, a Zen approach, a Zen path of self-reflection. That's Ezra Bayda, Bayda. He says in that book, our greatest insanity and also our deepest self-deception is believing our illusions as the unquestioned truth. I'm going to read that again for myself, if not for you. Our greatest insanity and also deepest self-deception is believing our illusions as the unquestioned truth. If I had to have one sentence that sort of identified what I am trying to do in my life at this stage in my life, this late stage in my life, it's that sentence. I am so interested in understanding how I am deceiving myself, what self-deceptions are ruling my mind and my behavior. So in this book, Ezra Bayda says, self-observation is greatly enhanced by what is called beginner's mind, a mind that is eager, without preconceptions and open to possibility. He says a good place to start when trying to observe your own hindrances is to ask, what is going on right now? What is my practice in this situation? So I'm very interested in these big questions of this sort, the kind that we just saw from Bruce Perry and now again from Ezra Beda. And in fact, I'm working on a talk I hope to do soon on questioning as a part of our contemplative practice. So what is going on, Beda asked. What is going on right now? What is my practice in this situation? This helps me remember that the distress, that is feelings of discomfort or anxiety or defeat, which often come up for me in my particular hindrance, I may be, whatever distress I may be feeling from a certain hindrance, that is the path itself. I lean toward the hindrance instead of ignoring it. I try, that's part of my practice. Let's lean into this hindrance rather than running away from it or ignoring it or assuming it's just a permanent flaw in my character, in my personality. So I want to recommend another book to you as we move forward to look at this. I can see I didn't finish my thought here. Let me just go back to one of my notes here. So we look at our hindrances as flaws, but the Stoics teach us, our difficulties are always our best teachers. That's really a hard notion to swallow, especially when you're right in the midst of a painful difficulty or stress of some sort. The first step is to gain awareness of where we are stuck. And then we can start moving forward. So a good place for beginning to identify the ways in which you are stuck is this small book that Peter turned me on to a couple of years ago by Gil Fronsdale called Unhindered, A Mindful Path Through the Five Hindrances. Unhindered, A Mindful Path Through the Five Hindrances. This is such a tidy little book. It's tight, it's well written, it's clear, it's concise, it gives detailed examples of how the hindrances manifest in our lives, as well as brief descriptions of what causes and conditions might have led to a particular hindrance. This book, in my opinion, along with Joseph Goldstein's book on mindfulness, my Bible, and Shayla Catherine's book, Beyond Distraction, the three of those books for me have offered a good bit of what any student of the Dharma would want to know about the hindrances, although there's been so much written on the hindrances, I shouldn't limit it to three books. But for me, these three scholars have been so important, and they agree that recognizing the hindrances and accepting that they are present is vitally important to the serious student of the Buddha's teachings. But of course, what we ultimately want, or maybe I should speak for myself, what I ultimately want is strategies. I want to know, just tell me what to do. Tell me what hoops I need to jump through to deal with this problem. So we want strategies, we want techniques, we want ideas for disarming these hindrances. And when it comes to firmly entrenched patterns in our psychology, recognition is necessary, but not sufficient. Think about that for a minute. Recognizing your hindrance is really necessary, but just recognizing it is not sufficient to actually disarm it or to move you more efficiently into your concentration practice. It is often painful to do this. As Peter explained in his introduction to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, this was on February 11th, if you want to go back to that talk, he mentioned again in that talk, as he has on several occasions, the importance of diligence, mindfulness, and clear knowing without attachment. They are called for. These qualities are necessary to our practice, and especially if we're going to begin examining our practice for the unique form of hindrances. Atapi sati sapajanya, diligence, mindfulness, and clearly knowing. Okay, so here is a brief overview, well, not so brief actually, of the way Gil Fronsdale describes the hindrances. In this case, we're not the hindrances in general. We're talking now about restlessness. Please go back to the previous 2 weeks if you didn't hear Susan and Allie's talk, because we're trying to do kind of a sequence, as you can see from the nice listing April has given us on the website. Homepage of the website has the list of all the talks that we'll be doing for the next few months. So here's what Fronsdale says about restlessness. Restlessness makes it difficult to concentrate and see clearly, as we've said before. The Pali word, this was new to me. I did not know this word. The Pali word for restlessness is udaka. Am I saying that right, Peter? Udaka, which means to shake. Restlessness often manifests as compulsive energy throughout the body. Compulsive energy throughout the body. And I thought, to shake, what an odd, I didn't at first quite see the connection for the Pali word for restlessness, which means to shake. And then I thought about my dog, Dash. You know, Dash, who died last year, but Dash was my best puppy ever, and such a good little girl, and sweet, a Bichon Frise, very nice temperament, as all Bichon Frises have. But when we would go out for a walk, occasionally, not often, she would get this, there would be a certain kind of dog that would rile her, didn't even have to approach her, and it would rile her, and she would just go into this vicious barking and just tense. Her whole body would be tense, and she was just like screaming at this dog. And then the dog would walk away, or I would pull her away, and she would stop. If I had her on a leash, she would stop, and then she'd just shake. And I'm sure you've seen dogs doing that. If you've watched Animal Planet or National Geographic and seen a lion chasing a gazelle, and when the herd gets away from the lion, they all shake. It's a form of lowering cortisol in your system. So I think that might be the connection there. I don't know, Peter might correct me on that, but that's the best I could do with that notion of shaking. So restlessness often manifests as compulsive energy throughout the body. It can be seen as fidgeting, shakiness, agitation, all kinds of tics and quirks and, you know, people getting up and sitting down. I had lots of experience with this as a college teacher because college kids are filled with nervous energy. Sometimes they'd have to stand up in class, or often I'd see their knees shaking like crazy, mostly more in men than in women, but that sort of, you know, just not even being aware that they're just expending a whole lot of energy shaking their knee up and down. Okay, scattered and persistent thinking happens in the mental realm. So this hindrance shows up not just in the body, in the physical realm, but in the mental realm too. And it manifests as scattered or persistent thinking, distraction, inability to focus, the mind jumping from one thing to another. We call it monkey mind, right? So again, you may find yourself in certain situations, or you may have friends. I have a very dear friend who has great restlessness in the mental realm, you know, easily distracted and easily confused, and moving back and forward in conversation. So this is not an uncommon trait for a human mind. This hindrance also, as I've mentioned before, includes agitated feelings of regret and worry. And Fronsdale says, strong regret and worry hinder our ability to relax and focus during meditation. So if you've got a strong regret that you're struggling with, Jim, thank you, confirming my theory about resetting their nervous system. Thank you so much for that. I wasn't far off, was I? So these teachers that I've mentioned give us clear techniques for how to practice with the hindrances. And I gotta say, Shyla Catherine's book on Beyond Distraction goes into great detail with strategies, techniques, all kinds of good advice and lists and questions for helping us examine. We don't have to resign ourselves to the hindrance that's keeping you from concentrating. There are lots of things that can be done. And so I think that I've talked about these techniques that Shyla Catherine uses in previous talks, so I'm not going to go into that today. I want to spend most of my time talking about Fronsdale and the techniques that he gives. But they all, many teachers give us very good techniques for how to practice with the hindrances and how to use the hindrances for your in your post-meditation investigation. So here are the primary, he lists several, but I'm going to just list the primary recommendations that Fronsdale gives us for dealing with restlessness and worry. And the first one is, you might suspect, is be mindful. That's sort of like the antidote to all problems in your practice. Be mindful. And he suggests, imagine the body as a larger container where energies are allowed to bounce around. Create a kind of internal spaciousness in your heart or in your lungs or in just in your torso. And I have worked with that and find that very helpful. If I can, sometimes I think we contract around the hindrance or the flaw, whatever it is we're dealing with in our practice. And many times just the very message to yourself to give that thought or that feeling or that irritation, whatever it is, give it more space. Imagine that it's in a larger room than just being all tied up in your chest center. So creating that larger internal space, it sounds small, like a small thing to do, but for me it's been very helpful. And along with that too goes just that means you're recognizing it. And then the other thing he says is to accept it. So the worst thing you can do is resist it, fight it, demean it, criticize it, get mad at yourself for once again being restless. No. Acceptance is the first step. Recognize the first step, acceptance the second step. In this practice, we are cultivating an aware heart. And by applying diligence and mindfulness, we are cultivating clear knowing. So the diligence comes in with the insistence on mindfulness, the returning again and again and again to the breath. That requires great diligence, great resilience. And through diligence and mindfulness, we are cultivating clear knowing. Oh, I love that. That's just so encouraging to me. The next thing that he talks about in the book is patience. Give yourself time. Be calm and gentle with yourself. Settling down and dealing with restlessness can take a while. So don't think just one thought about bringing more spaciousness into your heart is going to do the trick. It's something that we all have to practice with over and over and over. Another thing he says is not getting enough exercise can cause restlessness. And he spends quite a bit of time, well, not quite a bit, but enough, advocating the importance of a really serious exercise regimen. And so this, Satish, might be interesting to you or helpful to you, because I have found that walking meditation, so Franz Dale doesn't mention walking meditation in here, but I have found when I'm especially restless, and not, and especially if it's a physical thing, I'm like, you know, I'm just, I can't seem to settle my body down. If I get up and do walking meditation instead of a seated meditation, sometimes that will really help. So I mentioned my own challenge with restless legs and the Goenka retreat I was in last summer. And it was late in the retreat. I had not had this problem at all, but I got such a severe case of restlessness. I think it was like the eighth day of the class. And I thought I was going to jump out of my skin. And, you know, we were in the middle of the day, so I had, you know, like five more hours of meditation to go through. I just thought, what am I going to do? And on that day, I just got up and went over to the wall, and I pushed my scapula against the wall and just tried to really work on my breathing. And pretty soon, that restless leg problem went away. So just standing up sometimes can help. So exercise. Who would have thought that would be a recommendation for good meditation? Now, here's another thing that I think is probably not often talked about in terms of disarming hindrances. And that is, he says, notice when restlessness is not present. Well, the Buddha does this in on a number of occasions. I'm thinking especially in terms of right effort. You need to recognize when beneficial thoughts are inhabiting your mind, as well as when you're noticed, as well as you notice unbeneficial. We tend to focus on the negative thing, but Franz Dale is saying we need to really take notice of when restless is not, and take in that moment of calm and note it. And one of the things I do, I'm a, as I've said often in this group, I'm a writer and a avid journaler, and I keep a gratitude journal. And so I am really big on, in my own practice, on actually writing down when I notice that something that has bothered me or a flaw or a hindrance that has been with me is not present. I will go to my journal and write that down. So take in the moment of calm and non-restlessness and note it, and maybe even write it down in a little notebook that you would keep by your meditation chair. Here's another one that I think is so, so important. And Peter has talked about this often in talking about right livelihood or right lifestyle. Franz Dale says, notice what in your lifestyle results in restlessness. Clutter, the telephone beeping, beeping, beeping with notifications, scrolling, the TV on nonstop in your house, sleeplessness, strong desires, physical pain. These are all aspects of your lifestyle that result in restlessness and need to be dealt with. The one thing that he doesn't say in this category of examining your lifestyle for things that are causing restlessness is he doesn't talk about the people around you. I'm going to add that to his list. Notice the people around you who generate negative or agitated energy in your life. And I know every single one of you has at least one, if not a dozen, people like this in your life. It has been my lifelong effort to try to eradicate those people from my life. I haven't been quite so successful as I wanted to be, but I have been more successful in noticing when I am around somebody who just generates a negative or frenzied energy that hypes everybody in the room up. So that's one of my most important elements of dealing with restlessness. Okay, the next category that he lists here is conscious intention to cultivate contentment. And this sort of relates to what I was saying earlier about making note of when the hindrance is not present. I just have to reiterate that I think it's important to record moments of ease, joy, peace. And this is a way we cultivate contentment in our own lives. And contentment can be cultivated. And this notion of being conscious of your intentions around contentment, I think is just so important. And again, it tracks back to for me anyway, the importance of journaling. Learn to breathe through restlessness. He says, breathing conscious of the whole body can calm us physically. And in his introduction to this series, Peter, I went back, I was looking at the notes. That's how I can remember all of this about Peter's talk from the February 11th. But in that talk, Peter talked about offloading energy. I'm sorry, not energy, urgency. Peter said the best way to offload urgency is through attention to the breath. So that was so helpful to me because that, I'm not sure if urgency comes under the category of restlessness, but for me it kind of does because I know that for most of my life I've been driven by a pretty radical sense of urgency to get things done, to get things done, I guess, just this sort of driven sense of getting things done. And that has led for me, that sense of urgency has led to a pretty miserable kind of restlessness that I often experience. And I have to remind myself to drop urgency, or as Peter says, offload urgency. I like that a lot. The classic Buddhist instruction for restlessness and worry includes noticing what triggered. So triggering is a word you hear all the time in kind of the self-help realm and in the therapy realm. And I think this is really an important point that Fronsdale makes, that sometimes you need to try to stop and figure out what triggered this. What cause? Can you discern what might have been the causes and conditions for this restlessness? Was it a certain kind of person, or was it a certain kind of thought pattern that was causing this restlessness to arise? That's a really challenging thing to do all by yourself. But I'm going to make a couple of comments about doing this with a teacher, a trusted teacher, or doing it in groups. This is work that I find hard to do by myself. I feel like I need a group, a companion, a good teacher to help me move through these ideas. Okay, and of course, then if you could figure out what the causes and conditions were, then you could try to avoid those causes and conditions. It sounds so easy, but not so easy to do, really. Be mindful of the causes and conditions of restlessness may be more important, Fronsdale says, than actually being mindful of the restlessness itself. Pent-up aversion. Now, this is good because this ties us back into Allie's nice talk from last week. Pent-up aversion is a common cause of agitation, as are fear and resentment. So we know, well, maybe we don't know, but we certainly have been told of the dangers of aversive thinking, of aversive feelings, resistance. Resistance is a form of agitation to the mind and to the body. And then sort of related to this notion of pent-up aversion, he says strong opinions about what is or is not supposed to happen incite the mind to states of resistance and can be very toxic to concentration. Strong opinions. Now, many people think fondly of themselves if they think they are a person of strong opinions. But think about that a little bit. This notion can be something as simple as walking into a restaurant and not liking the restaurant because you don't like the wallpaper that's on the walls, or you don't like the way the waiter first treated you. I have the fortunate or unfortunate position of having a dear friend who is so riddled with strong opinions, and I can see how it incites her mind to resistance of all kinds, and then that brings her into a very definite form of restlessness. So this is a list. It's not a complete list from the book on Unhindered, but to me it's a good enough starting place for us. And I'm running out of time here, so I'm going to cut this short a little bit, because I think each of these suggestions for disarming restlessness can create a wider awareness of the particular nature of the hindrance, because each one of us has a unique dynamic, a unique relationship with the particular hindrance that bothers us most. Finally, and then I'll leave some time for questions, I just want to say something about the value of doing this work in group. So one of the things that I think is so valuable, or has been valuable for me anyway, in my own contemplative life, is being with a Sangha and being with a strong teacher and being able to be in study groups with that strong teacher who helps us really begin to look in a kind and intelligent way, helps us really look at the nature of our own hindrance, because we can be so blinded to what our hindrance is. So I really think doing this, if you're interested in doing this work, and this book is just such a beautiful little guide for doing it, if you want to get a study group together, April and I have done a workshop using this book, and it was just a great series of sessions that we had with a group, a fine group of people. So I really do advocate doing this work with other people. And it's not that reading isn't important. I'm a big reader, and in fact, sometimes can be too much of a reader. I like to read about things. I took tennis lessons, and before I played a single game of tennis, I read like 4 books on the art of playing tennis. So reading about what constitutes a hindrance is a good thing, but the sutra gives directives for extinguishing the hindrances. But Fronsdale and Shyla Catherine, as I mentioned before, give us concrete steps for investigation, showing us how to skillfully investigate these issues. But nothing compares to being in a safe space where you can examine your own patterns and see them reflected in the caring response of others. Examine the descriptions of each hindrance with a trusted cohort, then look closely at the hindrance that most plagues you. Once that hindrance is clearly on the table and you have noticed it and accepted it, you then can begin to investigate ways to disarm the hindrance. In my experience, studying the hindrances with other dedicated students of the Dharma is just so instructive and it's so motivating. We investigate our patterns together. We gain more insight, more confidence, more eagerness to move forward in our practice. And most dramatically, I want to say, we get to experience that feeling of going, oh, you have that problem too. You know that feeling when somebody confesses to you a problem that they have and you go, oh, I thought I was the only person that had that. You are not the only person that has all five of these hindrances. You are in very good company, and I encourage you to continue working with them. I'd love to read a quotation from Shaila Catherine, but I'm going to hold off on that and see if we've got some questions.
I can go, Leslie.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. I liked your comment about the paraphrase, mistaking some sort of internal concern as an unquestionable truth. It's not so easy to catch that. It's like, you know, your brain wants to say, just like this desk is wooden, that this thought that you have, of this thing that you're worried about, someone, whether it's something somebody perceived or whatever, is real. And you, we over and over tend to find out again that what we projected wasn't the deal, but we still keep doing it. That's interesting.
Very well said. Yes.
Interesting thing to watch, but sometimes I feel like you may not absolve yourself of all hindrances. You just shift the egg to different hindrance baskets. But the more I listen to these talks and practice and think about the practice, the more I think, okay, maybe you can just, maybe it is sensible to have more balance as someone that is that is less hindered over across the five. But there's so much interrelatedness between the five hindrances.
And
I think, so listen to these talks over the past couple of weeks, it seems like novelty seeking plays a role in a lot of these. Like desire from 2 weeks ago, that's obviously, that don't even need to say anything about that, but that's novelty seeking. But aversion seems to be somewhat the same. You're kind of in a process where you maintain an interest in what you're averted by.
Yeah.
You know, if you try to like smell for something you don't like, you're going to probably smell something you don't like eventually. Now this week, restlessness and worry, the same thing. I feel we get into a pattern of seeking new novelties to worry about or new aspects.
Absolutely. Oh, that's so good, Steve. I agree. Yeah.
So monkey mind, this makes me think about, I like my monkey mind some of the time, you know, all this novelty seeking, it isn't, I mean, I guess the practice of Vipassana, as Peter teaches it to us, it makes me think that that's really, you're downsizing all the novelty seeking to the subtleties of the breathing and the body, you know? So it's kind of like, it's almost like Vipassana is a practice of compressing or simplifying or downsizing this novelty seeking to the meditation practice.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
Yeah. It does. And I think another thing that you've made me think about is the importance of retreat. We've got a retreat coming up. Peter's doing a retreat for us on the 18th of April. I think that's the right date, 18th. Please join us. It's always a rewarding day. And I have found that being in longer sits, like a day-long sit, much less a 10-day sit, is really a good way to identify that novelty that you're trying to bring into your thought process, because you've got this larger time frame to let the mind range widely. And so anyway, thank you, Steve. That's a
yeah. And does that mean you're going to be at this this next one-day retreat?
Absolutely. It's on my calendar.
Great.
Leslie, I don't know if you can hear me. It's Sharon.
Yes. Hi, Sharon.
Well, you're discussing one of my most, let's say, difficult hindrance, and it's a persistent one for me. In exploring many of the things that you even some of the things you mentioned, One thing I wasn't clear on had to do with the body being a container and being reactive physically to the hindrance of restlessness or anxiety, or but then the mind also being almost separated from the body. And I kind of sense that in my experience, they play off of each other. The mind goes wild and the body responds, or vice versa.
Absolutely.
In the case of a restless leg or restless heart body situation circumstance. So I kind of wanted to make sure I didn't misunderstand what you were saying in terms of it plays out in certain ways with the mind and then.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. The body influences the mind and the mind influences the body. So it seems to be a loop.
Exactly that. Yeah. And thank you for not mentioning the vagus nerve, but I have to say it's also part of this whole thing. And for me, I'll just say awareness, like you mentioned, being aware when it's happening. I think at the very beginning you said that being aware of when it's happening and then taking a step to, as we might just breathe or focus on the breath, take a pause or just stop. Because for me, if I don't, it does tend to carry me away.
Yeah, that's very good advice you give there, my dear. Absolutely.
Well, I'm just observing. I'm only sharing what I observe in myself. And I wanted to mention bicycling because I do mostly find that combines my ability to burn off some of that physical experience. Mm-hmm. If I can push myself and push the thing that I'm pedaling. And you can do that in a lot of ways. You mentioned slow walking. For me, more exertion helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's so, it's idiosyncratic for each of us. We have to sort of find the methodology and the right dose of the methodology that's gonna work. And that's where diligence comes in, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Your talk was excellent. And the last thing that I want to ask is, might you consider a guided meditation for that particular hindrance? I don't know if you've done that.
I have not, but it's a great idea. Maybe you would like to do that for us.
I'm not sure that I can be settled enough for it, but I'll consider it.
Okay, good. We'll talk about that at the retreat.
We'll give you a couple of months of steady practice, Sharon, and then you just give us a guided meditation. But you have to sit for 45 minutes. How's that sound?
That is the hindrance that I stumble on all the time. And yeah. I will consider it, let's say, after I finish my taxes.
Okay. That taxes are such a good excuse for tolerating our hindrances.
Anybody? Hi, Leslie.
Yeah.
It's Robin.
Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me, and to, just be in one of your talks is always just such a pleasure for me, and I gained so much. And it's something you said tonight that really caught my attention was the allowing the energy to bounce inside of, around inside of your body, whether it's your torso, or I was thinking of my entire body. I think, it just made me think of when we're children, we're allowed to jump and run and, throw arms around and whatever it is, which would not be very attractive if a lot of adults are doing at the same time. But, when I'm in that meditative place and there is a lot of energy coming off me, just to allow, give that the opportunity, you know, to do what it needs to do, you know, and
absolutely
doesn't necessarily have to distract me, but in the background, it can be, you know, just moving around inside of me, doing whatever it needs to do. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point too. If you think about it, when you think about, I've not had children, but I've certainly seen this happen with parenting, where children will be in the house and they're being rowdy and they're being fussy and somebody starts crying and the mother or the father will get up and say, okay, enough, enough, everybody outside. That's what my parents used to do when things would get tense in the house, when kids were roughhousing or something. We would be sent outside and then we would like get the zoomies and, mm-hmm. you know, take care of that energy, mm-hmm. that sort of pent up energy. But if you're in a seated meditation practice for 8 hours, you can't go outside and run zoomies. So to me, that notion, I'm glad that resonated with you too, but because it really has been helpful to me to think about just imagine your innards growing, you know, your rib cage is pushing out and there's just more room there for that, whatever that energy is, to bounce around and roll around and dissipate then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that comment, yeah. Robin. And I'm thank so you. Happy you're here. Thank you.
Thank you. Me too.
Leslie?
Anybody else? Yeah.
As you were talking, I kind of thought about this when Steve was talking too, about the hindrances. We tend to compartmentalize them. It's almost as though, you know, there are five different colored rocks, you know, yeah. You hold a rock. It's not like that. Subjectively, there are qualities of perception and attention and energy. And mm-hmm. so when there's desire, there's restlessness also.
Mm-hmm.
Diversion, there's restlessness also. Sloth and torpor, not so much restlessness. Doubt, there's, you know, restlessness with doubt. So I think it's important to understand that what we're talking about is sort of like nuances of yeah. physical sensations and emotional processes that are associated with some kind of story. And
yes.
we can be, you know, that notion of, diligent, mindfully, clearly knowing is what reveals the way those different phenomena are interacting.
Yes, that is so helpful, Peter.
Detached from that, I think, is a key part of this whole practice.
Yeah, and it's like we almost, it's like any study of anything, you kind of have to break it down to make it manageable bite-sized pieces. So we look at each one, but you're so right that we all, as I said early on, we all have qualities of all of these hindrances to one degree or another. And I like the way you describe how that restlessness especially can be present in almost all of them, except maybe sloth and torpor. Nice point. Thank you. Okay, guys. I think we are sufficient for the evening, Peter.
Yes. Thank you, Leslie. I really appreciate it. Next week, April is going to talk about sloth and torpor. There will be a Zoom meeting. There will not be a meeting in this building because I'll be on retreat. And then I'm going to talk about the retreat following Wednesday. And I think it's important for folks to have a chance to talk about retreat experience because it's informational and maybe inspiring. So it's our custom at the end of our meetings to sit together in silence. So let's do that for a bit. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well. Hope we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.